It's the hardest thing in the world for me to fade that music because I love it. But I want even more to talk to writer and musician Jonathan Gould, whose brand new book is Burning Down the House, Talking Heads and the New York Scene That Transformed Rock. The book is just out from Mariner and is an absolute present for any of us who are Talking Heads fans and are fascinated by the impact of this group over time, blending research with sharp cultural insight. Jonathan traces the band's rise from New York's avant-garde scene to global stardom, unraveling how their art school roots, collaboration with Brian Eno and David Byrne's visionary aesthetic reshaped rock and performance art. It is great storytelling with a deep understanding of the era, showing the restless creativity and enduring influence of one of the most original bands in music history. And it's an absolute pleasure to welcome Jonathan Gould to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
I'm well, Joe, and it's a pleasure to be back here, if I may say.
I love having you back. When you reached out to me and told me that this book was, that this is your next book, I was so excited. This is really cool. Look, I'm an 80s kid. I grew up, and so this band was very prominent and central in my formation as a human as well as my musical tastes. What was it like to work on this project and say, okay, there's something here that with Talking Heads that resonates with people and something that is worth exploring, especially in such detail?
Well, so many people, to begin with, so many people say what you just said. I mean, people who grew up with this band, it wasn't just music that they listened to. It had a real effect on the people they became, or at least they think of it that way, or they thought of it that way. And of course, there's succeeding generations of people who have had a similar experience. They haven't really gone away, and so on. So what was it like? You know, it takes me a long time to do what I do, to write these books.
Right.
And so I want to always start by picking an artist that I'm sure of, that I'm not going to get 2 years into this thing and think, you know, well, actually, I don't really find this as interesting as I thought it was. And I was sure of it with them. They're exact contemporaries of mine. We're the same age. And part of the attraction of writing about them is my own background is as a professional musician. I spent the late 70s and early 80s playing in bands, playing in studios, so on and so forth, all the time trying to put together a great rock band. These folks did what I tried to do. And that's part of the fascination for me, having written about Otis Redding, who was an archetypal soul singer, and the Beatles, who are the archetypal rock group. That's a different thing. But this is a second-generation rock group, and I felt a great kinship, not just with their music, but with the what it took for them to achieve what they did.
In the mid-1980s, I was working at an independent bookstore, Friartuck Books in Saratoga Springs in the Pyramid Mall. I remember this, Jonathan, as clear as anything. A customer walked in, and they were picking up a book that they had ordered on the Beatles. And they went over to the magazine rack, and they picked up Time Magazine. And on Time Magazine was David Byrne.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman turned around to me, showed me the cover of the magazine, and said, "What has happened to our world?" And I thought, wow, that is such a cool perspective. And certainly not alone in it. But when you say second generation, I mean, that's the switch, right? This
Sure.
is where things get different and people come to terms with that.
Yes, very much. And of course, you know, David's appearance on the cover of Time magazine in an era when the cover of Time magazine this was the standard of arrival,
right,
in many ways.
Right.
Was a powerful thing. Of course, the headline read "Rock's Renaissance Man," and it talked about the fact that he was not only the lead singer in Talking Heads, but had also been involved with Twyla Tharp in an avant-garde dance piece. And of course, Stop Making Sense, which was really the high point of their whole career in some ways. Of course, one of the issues with that is that directing that sort of attention at one member of a band, as you can well imagine, created tensions in the band, created problems in the band that contributed ultimately to their ending their career together. But that goes with the territory, I guess you'd have to say.
So, I mean, talking heads on, they don't want to look at, certainly undermine any of the other musicians in this, but this is David Byrne's story, isn't it?
Well, yes, and part of writing it well, I think, was not to overemphasize that aspect to it. One can't speculate about these things that intelligently, but had he never met Chris Franz, had he never met Tina Weymouth, had they never taken on Jerry Harrison, would we be sitting here talking about David Byrne as this major cultural figure? It's kind of hard to say, and it's important to credit that. That said, though, David is an outsized talent. There's no other way to describe him, and he was an outsized talent in that band. And my admiration for him only grew as I got deeper into understanding both his creative method and some of the personal qualities that contributed to that creative method, which are very complicated and very interesting.
We don't have enough time to talk about all of it, but how would you describe that creative method in the sense of? Because it seems like he's always trying to, I mean, you even look now of what he's doing. There was American Utopia and then now this new project, which will hit theaters in the fall. I mean, it's always doing something different and it's always advancing something that he was working on, either advancing or completely trying something new.
Sure. David is always on to the next thing. And I think he has a restless creativity, I guess is the best way to describe it. It's not to say that he doesn't draw on what he's done before. He always does. But there's always that. I think one of the reasons that he didn't speak with me for Attribution about this book is, quite frankly, he's not that interested in talking about the music that he made 30 and 40 years ago. David is focused on whatever he's doing next in that sense. And as I say, there are good reasons for that. There are interesting reasons for that that yes, can be we could be talked about it at great length and are discussed at great length or at some length anyway in the book.
When one of the things that you talk about in the book is his Asperger's,
mm-hmm.
and he's talked about this,
sure.
But it does have an impact in the music, doesn't it? I mean, a very strong impact.
Yes, Asperger's. We still don't really understand what we're talking about when we talk about this, because of course when David was growing up there was no such thing as Asperger's. It had not been identified. The notion of high functioning autism, which we're all very familiar with mm-hmm. now, had not been identified in that sense. But the first thing I do want to say about it is it's important not to be reductionist about this. It's important not to make this characteristic of David Byrne the explanation for who he is. But that said, people with high-functioning autism have many of them, rather, I don't want to generalize too much, many of them have extraordinary powers of concentration, extraordinary powers of observation. And those two things, when they're combined with a strong work ethic, is sort of a prescription for originality in art. And I think a lot of David's originality comes from the unusual perspective that he has on things, some of which is not all that comfortable to live with, but as I say, can feed an artistic sensibility in a very interesting way. And my main interest, as I say, in his Asperger's is its effect on his creative sensibility, not so much his personal relationships and so on and
right.
so forth, which is another story.
But it makes him an interesting, I mean, I don't know what makes him, I'm not mm-hmm. saying it's that, but what makes him an interesting performer too is there is this incredible talent. This incredible, I would say, much of the music is joyful,
mm-hmm.
and yet also there's this innate awkwardness
sure.
that exists, which is fascinating.
No, it is, and that is a big part of what he's been able to turn into art is his own awkwardness, his own disquiet, his own uncomfortable social sort of interactions with people, by the way, which has moderated a great deal over time with a lot of work, I think, on his part.
The other thing, too, though, and I was thinking about this while reading the book, Jonathan, was about, so there's an awkwardness, but oh my God, the confidence. Right. Yeah. I mean, just you saw that in American Utopia, and you certainly see it when he comes out, because he is in command.
Yes. Absolutely. And this too is part of his artistic journey. I mean, the kid who was standing on the stage at CBGB's when they first began performing in 1975 was not confident, was not any of those things. I write that he looked so uncomfortable. He looked like he was about to make a break for the door rather than command the stage in that way. So it's again, this is about a personal journey that corresponds to an artistic journey. And now, of course, David Byrne is this almost avuncular character. You know, when American Utopia was produced on Broadway, I think it was Ben Brantley in the New York Times who compared David Byrne to Mr. Rogers as this sort of kindly sort of figure. Well, there again, go back to the singer of Psycho Killer in 1975. That doesn't sound like someone who's heading in the direction of a Mr. Rogers character.
No, but you know, I thought it was fascinating. Again, this was, I think, just right before or close, maybe around the same time. But when John Mulaney did the Sack Bunch, and David Byrne was such a part of that, you felt that that Mr. Rogers feel to it, which I thought was really interesting.
I mean, David has chosen, I think, for very good reasons, to emphasize his optimism, to emphasize his kindliness. And there's a great deal of both those qualities in him. Sometimes I think fans of his older music might be looking for some hint of that older disquiet. I mean, David himself described torment as an important aspect of his creative method, but we don't see much of that nowadays. We may see the results of it, but we don't get much of a sense of that from him now. But back then, torment was a big part of what he was able to put across, but not in a way that was in a way that invited you into trying to understand where he was coming from and what he was about.
Who is the Sky is the new album and the concert that will be coming this fall. And I'm showing Jonathan a picture that I'm sure he's well aware of,
sure,
of David Byrne putting on this light suit that I assume is going to be a part. But you look at that, it's just fascinating because he's covered in this suit of light. It's like the big jacket, right?
I mean, we shall see. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's really interesting.
There too, there's always a there's a great consistency for all of the originality, for all of the on to the next thing. There's a great consistency to his whole career. So yes, indeed, this is the big suit was one defining feature of him and stopped making sense. Now he's on to another type of suit. But interestingly enough, it's a suit. It has to do with what he's going to be wearing when he's performing and how he's going to pull it off.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. You did a masterful job in bringing this story out, and I can't imagine it was easy to get everybody together, but it was really fascinating.
Well, thank you so much. I thoroughly appreciate that, and I look forward to talking some more about it.
Are you doing any events local?
Yes, I'm doing a reading at Oblong Books.
Actually,
it's not just a reading. It's a reading and conversation with Joe Hagan, who wrote the great book about Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone magazine. This will be at Oblong Books on June 28th, which is a Saturday, at 6 o'clock in the evening, and people are welcome to come. They tell me they have a great deal of standing room only. The seats are sold out, but if you're willing to stand there and listen to me and Joe talk for a while, we'll welcome your presence.
You can lean, too. Oblongbooks.com, oblongbooks.com, the name of the new book, Burning Down the House, Talking Heads, and the New York Scene that Transformed Rock Music. It's published by Mariner Books. Jonathan Gould, an absolute delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.